The Copper Kettle's bathhouse was plainly furnished, but well-built and fully equipped. Corrus spent the better part of an hour immersed up to the neck, eyes half-closed in drowsy content as steaming water soaked the ache out of his muscles. He'd endured more time on horseback, or in one of the bouncing, jouncing stagecoaches that bounded between posting houses on the more heavily traveled stretches, over the past few months than in his entire previous existence, and he felt every weary mile of it deep in his bones. To be fair, the high roads here in Howard were far better designed, built, and maintained than their ostensible counterparts in Coruscant had ever been. Broad, stone-paved, with well-designed drainage and solid bridges, they'd made it possible for him to maintain an average of just over 100 miles a day. He could never have done that on Coruscantian roads, and to be honest, he wished he hadn't had to do it on Howard's roads either. The fact that it was possible didn't make it anything remotely like pleasant, and the Earl's lifetime preference for sea travel had been amply reconfirmed over the month since his departure from Talkeira. Of course, that had been the easy part of his projected journey, he reminded himself glumly as he hoisted himself out of the water at last and reached for the towel which had been warming in front of the huge tiled stove that heated the bathhouse. The Gulf of Dolar in October was about as miserable a stretch of seawater as anyone could ever hope to find. And while Corrus had formed a high initial impression of Captain Euthane's competence, Ice Lizard was a galley, not a galleon. She was shallow draft, low slung, and sleek, and it was obvious to the Earl's experienced eye that she was going to be Shan Wei's own bitch in a seaway. Assuming they survived the passage of the Gulf, which seemed at least an even bet, if Captain Euthane proved as skilled as Corrus thought he was, there was the delightful prospect of another 1,300 miles of overland travel, this time through the belly-deep snows of November, just to reach the southern shores of Lake Pei. And then there was the even more delightful prospect of the 400-mile trip across the lake, which would undoubtedly be frozen over by the time he got there, which, in turn, meant he would have to make the entire trip, oh joy, by ice boat. That experience, he had no doubt, would make Ice Lizard look exactly like the fine cruise ship Euthane had assured him she wasn't. "It's a good thing you're not 50 yet, Philip," he told himself glumly as he finished toweling off and reached for the linen drawers Sea Blanket had thoughtfully placed to warm in front of the stove. "You'll probably survive. It's a good thing you made sure your will was in order ahead of time. But you'll probably survive, until you actually get to Zion, at least." And that was the crux of the matter, really, wasn't it? What was going to happen once he reached Zion and the temple? The fact that the writ summoning him had been signed by the Grand Inquisitor as well, not just the Chancellor, hadn't exactly put his mind at ease. Not surprisingly, he supposed, since he rather doubted it had been intended to do anything of the sort. Trenaire and Clinton couldn't possibly see Diven as anything more than a potentially useful pawn. Someday, if he could finally somehow reach the chessboard's final file, he might be elevated, converted into something more valuable than that. But Diven Dakin was only a very little boy when all was said, and Clinton, at least, would never forget for a moment that pawns were meant to be sacrificed. Corrus had done his best to reassure Iris, and he knew the princess far too well to serve up comforting lies in the effort. In the Earl's opinion, the girl was even smarter than her father had been, and she wasn't afraid to use the wit God and the archangels had given her. She had all her father's ability to carry a grudge until it died of old age, then have it stuffed and mounted someplace where she could admire it at regular intervals, but, so far at least, she'd usually shown a fair amount of discretion in choosing which grudges to hold. That might well change, indeed might already have changed, given how her world had been shattered into topsy-turvy ruin in the last year or so. But despite her youth, she was just as capable as Corus himself when it came to reading the political wind, recognizing the storm clouds gathering about her younger brother. That was why he'd told her the absolute truth when he'd said he doubted the group of four had any immediate plans for how they might most profitably utilize Diven. Yet, sooner or later, they would have plans, and that was the reason they'd decided to drag him all these thousands of miles through a mainland winter. When the time came, they would want to be certain Philip Osgood understood his place, recognized his true masters with a clear vision, unblinkered by any lingering, misplaced loyalty to the House of Dakin. They intended to underscore that to him, and to see him for themselves form their own judgment of him. And if that judgment proved unfavorable, they would remove him from his position as Diven's and Iris's guardian. If he was quite unreasonably lucky, he might even survive the removal rather than be quietly and efficiently disappeared. At the moment, he'd give odds of, at least 1 in 50 that he would. "Well, Philip, my boy," he thought, slipping into an embroidered steel thistle silk shirt, "you'll just have to see that they form a favorable opinion, won't you? Shouldn't be all that hard. Not for an experienced, conniving liar such as yourself. All you have to do is keep any of them from getting close enough to figure out what you really think. How hard can it be?"
"I've got to be getting back to the Copper Kettle," Robert Seablanket said. "He's bound to be finished with his bath by now. He'll want his dinner, and as soon as I get it served, he'll wonder why I'm not in the bathhouse myself." He grimaced. "For that matter, I'll wonder why I'm not neck deep."
"I understand," the man on the other side of the rickety desk in the small dockside warehouse office replied. The office wasn't exceptionally clean, nor was it particularly warm, and its tiny window was so thoroughly covered with grime no one could possibly have seen through it, all of which only served to make it even better suited to their purposes. "I understand," the other man repeated, "and so far at least I think my superiors are going to be satisfied. At any rate, I don't think anyone's going to want to give you any more proactive instructions."
"I hope not," Seablanket said with obvious feeling. The other man arched an eyebrow and the valet snorted. "This man is no fool, father. I'm confident of everything I've reported so far, and I think your superior's original estimate of his character probably wasn't far wrong. But I'd really rather not be asked to do anything that might make him start wondering about me. If he ever realizes I'm reporting everything he does to someone else, he's likely to do something drastic about it. Please, don't forget he was Hector's spymaster. You know, the one all of Hector's assassins reported to?"
Seablanket grimaced.
"Coruscantian intelligence was never too shy about dropping suitably weighted bodies into handy lakes or bays, or swamps for that matter. And the two of us are about to sail across the Gulf of Dolar in winter. I'd sort of like to arrive on the other side."
"Do you think it's really likely he'd react that way?" The other man actually seemed a bit amused, Seablanket noted sourly.
"I don't know, and if it's just the same to you, father, I'd rather not find out. It's always possible he'd exercise a little restraint if he figured out who planted me on him the last time he was in Yushai, but he might not, too. For that matter, he might not care who it was."
"Well, we can't have that."
The other man stood, straightening his purple, flame-badged cassock, and raised his right hand to sign Langhorne's scepter in blessing.
"My prayers will go with you, my son," he said solemnly.
"Oh, thank you, father."
It was perhaps a sign of just how preoccupied Sea Blanket truly was with the more immediate threat of the Earl of Corus's possible reactions that he allowed his own irritation to color his tone. Or it might simply have been how long he'd known the other man. Perhaps he realized it wasn't actually quite as risky as someone else might have thought. After all, even one of the Grand Inquisitor's personal troubleshooters could have a sense of humor when all was said. November, Year of God, 893. 1. Imperial Palace, City of Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm, and HMS Dawn Wind, 54 Dolphin Reach.
"What do you think about Merlin's and Al's latest reports on Coruscant, Michael?" Charlian asked.
She and Caleb sat in Prince Tymon's suite, the rooms just down the hall from their own suite, which had been converted into a combined library and office. It lacked the remodeled heated floors of their bedroom, but a brand-new cast-iron stove from the Hausmann Ironworks had been installed, and the coal fire in its iron belly gave off a welcome warmth.
"You've both seen the same imagery I have from Merlin's snarks," Michael Stainer pointed out over the plug in her right ear.
His voice sounded remarkably clear for someone better than 4,000 miles as the wyvern flew from Chiraeth.
"What do you think?"
"No, you don't," Caleb shot back with a grin. "We asked you first."
Stainer cleared his throat severely, and Charlian grinned at her husband. Their contact lenses brought them the Archbishop's image as he sat in his shipboard cabin, looking out over a sunset sea, with Arden draped across his lap. His own lenses showed him her grin as well, and he made a face at her. But then he shrugged, and his tone was more serious as he continued.
"As far as the church goes, I think we've been extremely blessed with Gerling, and especially men like Father Tymon," he said very soberly. "We're not going to find any Carisian patriots in Coruscant, even among the clergy, any time soon. But the reform element in the Coruscantian hierarchies proved rather stronger than I dared hope before the invasion. And the really good news, in many ways, is how many of those reformists are native-born Coruscantians, like Father Tymon. That puts a Coruscantian face on Voices of Reason, and that's going to be incredibly valuable down the road." "From a more purely political perspective," the Archbishop continued, "I think General Cherman and Anvil Rock and Tartarian are about as on top of things as we could reasonably ask, Your Majesty." "That's Benjamin's opinion, too, for that matter. Neither of us sees how anybody could be doing a better job, anyway, given the circumstances of Hector's murder and the fact that there probably aren't more than a half dozen people in all of Coruscant, even among the most reform-minded members of the priesthood, who think Caleb wasn't behind it."
"Agreed," Caleb said, his own expression sober. "All the same, I have to admit, I'd feel a lot better if the Brethren would let us go ahead and bring Howell fully inside. If we'd been able to give somebody in Coruscant one of Merlin's comms, I'd sleep a lot more soundly at night."
Charlian nodded, although, truth to tell, she wasn't entirely certain she would have been in favor of giving Howell Cherman a communicator. It wasn't that she doubted the Marine General's loyalty, intelligence, or mental toughness in the least. No, the problem was that despite Cherman's genuine hatred for the Group of Four, he still believed, deeply and completely, in the Church's doctrine. As with Regis Yawans and Marak Sandirs, there was simply no way to know how he might react if they tried to tell him the truth.
"And it's not as if they're the only ones that's true of," she acknowledged unhappily to herself. "Or as if they were the only ones who could be so much more capable if we only dared to tell them everything we know."
Unfortunately, they couldn't, despite the difficulties that created. It was bad enough that they couldn't tell Grey Harbor, given his position as the effective first counselor of the Carisian Empire. But Sondiers, the Baron of Green Mountain, was at least equally important in light of his duties as first counselor of the Kingdom of Chisholm. Not to mention the tiny fact that he's Mother's lover, whether I'm supposed to know that or not, and the man who taught me everything I know about being a queen, she thought unhappily. Why, oh why, couldn't the two political advisers Caleb and I both lean most heavily upon have just a little bit less integrity, where the church is concerned at least?
I've done my best to ginger up Jean and the others, Your Grace, Stainer told Caleb, his tone a bit wry. And I have to say, in the interests of fairness, that they've actually become much more flexible about approving additions to your inner circle. After being so miserly with their approval for so long, for so many entire generations of the Brethren, when you come down to it, that's really quite remarkable when you think about it. Agreed, Caleb said once more, acknowledging his Archbishop's slightly pointed but unmistakably admonishing tone. Agreed, and however irritating it may sometimes be, I have to admit that having someone put the brakes on my own occasional bursts of excessive enthusiasm isn't exactly a bad thing. The Emperor made a face. I think all monarchs have a tendency to fall prey to expediency if they aren't careful. And sometimes I think the rest of the Brethren might have had a point when they worried about that youthful impatience of mine while they debated telling me about it. I don't think I'd go quite that far, Stainer replied. At the same time, though, I won't pretend I'm not relieved to hear you say that either. Oh, I'm maturing, I am, Caleb assured him dryly. Having Merlin and Charlie right here at hand to whack me over the head at the drop of a hat tends to have that effect, you know.
Maybe it would if your skull wasn't quite so thick, his wife told him, smiling as she ran her fingers through his hair. He smiled back at her, and she snorted in amusement. But then she leaned back in her own chair and shook her head. At least where Coruscant is concerned, you and I are closer than Telesburg at the moment, she pointed out aloud. And even with the overwater links, the semaphore between here and there, or from here to a race store, for that matter, works for us now, not the group of four. We can get dispatches to Manchir a lot quicker from Chiraeth.
That helps, Caleb agreed. In fact, as far as the semaphore's concerned, we're actually better placed here than we would be in Telesburg, since Chiraeth's much closer to our geographic center. It's not the same as being there to keep an eye on things in Coruscant myself, though. And for that matter, I'm none too delighted at having to send them overland through Zebediah, even if we did personally vet the semaphore managers, he added a bit sourly.
No, it's not the same as being there, she acknowledged.
On the other hand, they both knew why he wasn't still in Manchir, personally overseeing the rest of Princedom's incorporation into the Empire. And completely leaving aside all of the personal reasons she was glad he wasn't, including the one which was just beginning to affect her figure, the cold-blooded political calculation which had brought him home to Chiraeth seemed to be proving out in practice. Charlian wasn't foolish enough to think Earl Anvil Rock and Earl Tartarian were going to keep the lid nailed down on the conquered princedom's many and manifold boiling resentments forever. The spontaneous street demonstrations in Manchir, and quite a few of them truly were spontaneous, she admitted, completely independent of the activities of people like Patrick Hainry, were an ominous indication of heavy weather just over the horizon. But it was obvious from Merlin's snarks that it would have been even worse if Caleb had remained in Coruscant. At least, unlike Caleb, Anvil Rock and Tartarian were also Coruscantians themselves, and at least they were governing Coruscant, officially at any rate, as the regents of Prince Divan, not in the name of a foreign conqueror.
Everyone might still see that foreign conqueror lurking just behind Divan's empty throne, yet it still gave them a degree of legitimacy in Coruscantian eyes, which Viceroy General Cherman simply could not have enjoyed. Of course, that was its own jar of worms, and a particularly squirmy jar it was, too.
"I wish I didn't sympathize with Iris as much as I do," she thought grimly. "And I know I can't afford to let that sympathy influence me. But I also know what it's like to have your father murdered. I know exactly what that can do to someone. And however much I may have loathed and hated Hector Dakin, he was her father. She loved him as much as I loved mine, and she's never going to forgive Caleb for having him assassinated any more than I ever forgave Hector for buying my father's murder."
Charlian Armok was only too well aware of the bitterly ironic parallels between herself and Iris Dakin, and despite her own burning hatred for Hector of Coruscant, she truly did feel a deep, pain-laced sympathy for Hector's surviving orphaned children. And if there was one person on the face of Safehold who would never underestimate just how dangerous a mere girl's blazing determination to avenge that murder could truly be, it was Charlian of Chisholm.
"Which only makes me worry even more about Lartroth, Stormkeep, and all of their damned friends and neighbors. If only we could just go ahead and arrest them all for what we know they're doing."
That, however, was the one thing they absolutely couldn't do. Caleb had been right when he'd decided he couldn't simply replace conquered princes and nobles with people who would inevitably be seen as his favorites. No, he had to leave legitimate nobles who had sworn fealty to him in place, unless and until he had incontrovertible proof the princes and nobles in question had been guilty of treason. Which, since they couldn't possibly present evidence from the Snarks in any open court, meant all they could do was to keep a wary eye on what Merlin had christened the Northern Conspiracy. And, if she were honest, she wished even more passionately that they could move openly even against the street agitators. She supposed there really wasn't any reason they couldn't arrest commoners on suspicion, assuming there'd been some way to identify them to General Cherman, or to Corin Garvey. But just how did one go about identifying them to anyone outside the inner circle without raising all sorts of potentially disastrous questions? And even leaving aside that not-so-minor consideration, did they really want to start down that road? She didn't doubt there might come a time when they'd have no choice. But, as Caleb had just pointed out, it was always tempting, and seldom wise, to succumb to expediency. As far as she was concerned, she'd prefer to delay that time when they had no choice for as long as possible. Of course, there were some other weighty, purely pragmatic arguments in favor of their current hands-off approach as well. The database of agitators Merlin had Owl building continued to grow steadily, and there were many advantages in letting that proceed undisturbed, up to a point at least. Not only would they know where to find their organized enemies when the moment finally came, but letting the other side do its recruiting undisturbed also served to draw the most dangerous opposition together in one group, to give them a single target they could decapitate with a single strike. And, she reflected, sifting through Owl's reconnaissance take, as Merlin calls it, helps us evaluate why someone joined the resistance. I never realized how valuable that could be until he pointed it out. Knowing what motivates people to actively oppose you is incredibly useful when it comes to evaluating the effectiveness of your policies, or how other people perceive those policies, at any rate. And it doesn't hurt to be able to judge the character of your opponents either. Not everyone who joins up with people like Hainry and Wyman belongs in the same basket with them.
There are good and decent people on the other side. People who genuinely think what they're doing is the right thing, what God wants them to do. It's hard enough remembering that, even with the proof right in front of us. Without it, I don't think I'd be able to remember at all when sentencing time rolls around. At least the effort wasn't burning up as much of their time as it might have. Now that Merlin had gotten the process up and running, Owl routinely assigned parasite sensors to each additional anti-Karras activist as he was identified. At this point, neither Merlin nor Caleb or Charlian were trying to keep track of everyone being added to the files. If the filters Merlin had put in place were doing their jobs, Owl would identify any important Coruscantian churchman, noble, or member of parliament who crossed the path of anyone in the database. At that point, those involved would be brought to Merlin's attention and flagged for closer future observation. Several of the more important, or more active at least, of the street agitators had also been added to the special watch list, and Owl routinely notified Merlin of anyone new who crossed those people's paths, regardless of the newcomer's rank. For the most part, though, all they were really doing was to develop their list of active opponents and continue to chart the slowly growing, steadily more sophisticated organization those opponents were putting in place. And hard as it was watching it grow when they couldn't nip it in the bud, none of them were foolish enough to think they could have prevented it from happening, in one form or another, whatever they did. "And sooner or later, we will be in a position to break their organization too," Charlian thought. "In fact, sooner or later we'll have to. And not just in Manchir, either. The Northern Conspiracy is going to be on our little list, too. Eventually, they will give us evidence we can use, once we discover it through more acceptable avenues. And when we do, they'll discover just how efficient our headsmen are." She was rather looking forward to that day, actually. "Well," she said, "at least it doesn't look like Coruscant's going up in flames tomorrow morning. It doesn't hurt that you're on your way for your first pastoral visit both here and in Coruscant either, Michael. And I imagine," her voice turned just a bit smug, undeniably it turned smug, "that once word gets out that we're finally about to produce an heir, it's going to upset certain people I could mention almost as much as it's going to reassure all of our people." "Oh, I'm sure it is," Caleb agreed in a tone of profound satisfaction. "I'm sure it is." "And neither is Emerald," Stainer told them both. "Going up in flames, I mean." None of them were speaking loudly, but the Archbishop's voice was lower pitched than either Caleb's or Charlian's. They had the advantage of thick stone walls and of a heavy door of solid near oak, warded by two Imperial Guardsmen personally selected for their duty by Merlin Athrawis and Edward Seahamper. No one was going to get close enough to eavesdrop on them. Stainer, on the other hand, was ensconced in the Admiral's cabin aboard HMS Dawn Wind, one of the Carisian Navy's newer galleons. As quarters went aboard cramped, overcrowded warships, it was a spacious abode, well suited to the Archbishop's dignity and the privacy the duties of his office, not to mention his own need for meditation and prayer, frequently required. Of course, it was aboard one of the aforementioned cramped, overcrowded warships, which was to say that the bulkheads were thin, the doors were anything but solid near oak, and people were likely to inadvertently intrude upon his privacy at any moment. Fortunately, he'd already firmly established a tradition of retiring to his cabin every evening to enjoy the sunset through the stern windows and meditate. By now, his staff was accustomed to protecting his privacy during those moments. As long as he kept his voice down and the cabin skylight closed, it was extremely unlikely anyone would hear his voice over the inevitable sounds of a sailing ship underway. and even less likely that anyone who heard him speaking would be able to make out words. The logical assumption would simply be that he was praying, and anyone who thought that was what was happening would get themselves out of eavesdropping range as quickly as they could.
In fact, the Archbishop continued now, I think Emerald is going to be almost as happy to hear about your pregnancy as anybody in Old Carris or Chisholm, Charlian. They're committed now, they know that, and they're as eager to see the succession secured as anyone else.
Really? Charlian said. I think that's been my own impression, she admitted. But I also have to admit I've been a little afraid it was my impression because that was the impression I wanted to have, if you follow me.
She grimaced slightly.
In some ways, I think, having all this access, courtesy of Merlin Snarks, only makes it harder to figure out what people are really thinking. I've spent years training myself to estimate things like that accurately on the basis of second and third-hand reports. Interpretively, I suppose you might say. Now I'm actually trying to look at people directly and decide for myself, and I've discovered that it's hard to get some sort of objective feel for what that many people are really thinking from direct observation. No wonder Merlin's tended to get himself buried under the data overload.
Her voice softened with the final sentence, and Caleb nodded in agreement. He still didn't fully understand how the high-speed data interface Merlin's Pika body had once possessed had functioned, but he didn't have to understand how it worked to understand what it had done, or to understand how bitterly Merlin regretted its loss. Having had personal experience now of the sheer quantity of imagery and audio recordings flooding in through Merlin's planet-circling network of reconnaissance platforms, he only wished he had a high-speed interface. Fortunately, they were making at least a little progress. And while Caleb wasn't positive, he suspected Owl was getting progressively better at sorting and prioritizing information. Whatever Owl was doing, though, the ability to assign specific portions of what Merlin called the intel take to someone besides just Merlin had helped enormously. There were limitations, of course. No one else had Merlin's built-in comm equipment. They had to speak out loud instead of sub-vocalizing if they wanted to communicate with Owl or anyone else, which severely limited where and when they could interact with the AI. And all of them were also creatures of flesh and blood, prey to all the weaknesses of the flesh, including the need for food and at least a reasonable amount of sleep. For that matter, even Merlin had discovered the hard way that he did need at least the equivalent of rest if he was going to maintain his mental focus. More to the point, Caleb had figured that out as well, and ordered him to take the downtime he needed to stay fresh and alert. Which, in fact, was precisely what he was doing at this very moment, or he'd damned well better be at any rate, because if Caleb or Charlian caught him listening in when he was supposed to be sleeping, and Al had been ordered to report him if it happened, there'd be hell to pay.
Well, in this case, Your Majesty, I think your impression is accurate, Stainer told her. As a matter of fact, I suppose I might as well go ahead and admit I was hugely relieved by my own observations here.
Here wasn't actually quite the correct word anymore, Charlian reflected. Dawn Wind had sailed from Erastor Bay on the afternoon tide. At the moment, she was making her way, slowly, especially for someone who had experienced Merlin's recon skimmer, out into the western half of Dolphin Reach, and she was no wyvern, able to ignore reefs, shoals, islands, currents, and unfavorable winds. If they were lucky, and if Dawn Wind managed, oh, unlikely event, to avoid any major storms and made a relatively quick passage for this time of year, she would cover the 7,300 sea miles to Chiraeth in only about 10 5-days. Charlian hated,
absolutely hated having Stainer stuck aboard a ship for that long. Yet she'd been forced to agree with him that it wasn't really as if they had a lot of choice. It was essential for the ordained head of the Church of Karras to visit all of the new Empire's lands. And unlike the Church of God Awaiting, the Church of Karras had decreed from the outset that its bishops and archbishops would be permanent residents of their sees. Instead of making brief annual visits to the souls committed to their care, they would make one, and only one, visit to the Church of Karras' annual convocation each year. The rest of their time would be spent at home, seeing to their own and their flock's spiritual needs, maintaining their focus on what truly mattered. And the Church's annual convocation would be held in a different city every year, not allowed to settle permanently into a single location, which would inevitably become an imperial city, the Karizian equivalent of the city of Zion in its own right. That meant the Archbishop of Karras would be traveling most years just as surely as any of his subordinate prelates. It would have been unthinkable for any grand vicar to make the same sort of journey and subject himself to all the wearying effort involved in it, or, for that matter, the inescapable perils of wind and weather inherent in such lengthy voyages. But that was fine with Michael Stainer. The greater and more numerous the differences between the Church of Karras and the Church of God Awaiting, the better, for a lot of reasons, as far as he was concerned, and he was determined to establish the pattern firmly. Firmly enough that no empire-building successor of his would find the tradition easy to subvert. His current tour was part of building that tradition. Yet it was more than that, too, for he was determined to personally visit every capital of every political unit of the Karizian Empire, and as many more of the major cities as he could manage as well. As Wind Thunder had so grumpily pointed out before his departure for Emerald, it was a security nightmare in many respects. God only knew how many temple loyalists would simply have loved to stick something sharp and pointy between the ribs of arch-heretic Stainer, as the loyalist broadsides had dubbed him. But the number had to be enormous. The attempt had already been made once, right in his own cathedral. Who knew what kind of opportunities might arise or might be manufactured in someone else's cathedral? On the other hand, he was right. He had to establish that kind of personal contact with as much as possible of the new church's clergy if he expected that clergy to accept that he truly cared about its worries, its concerns, its agonizing crises of conscience as it coped with the spiritual demands of schism. And he does care, Charlian thought. He truly does. He understands what he's asking of them. I don't believe anyone not completely blinded by intolerance and hatred could fail to recognize that after 5 minutes in his presence, and that's the exact reason he has to be doing this. However much what I really want to do is lock him up safe and sound inside Telesburg Cathedral and the Archbishop's Palace.
So you're satisfied about Emerald, at least, where the church is concerned, I mean, Caleb said, and Stainer nodded. I don't think Prince Narman's Emeraldians have quite as much fire in their bellies, let's say, as we have back home in Telesburg, he said. On the other hand, they weren't the people the group before intended to have raped and murdered, either. At the same time, though, I was deeply gratified by how clearly people in Emerald already recognized the fundamental corruption that let the group before come to power in the first place. It's become increasingly evident to me that many, indeed I'm tempted to say most, if that's not a case of letting my own optimism run away with me, of Emerald's churchmen saw the temple's corruption long before Narman ever decided to swear fealty to the two of you, at any rate. And believe me, those who did recognize it know they could have been Clinton's next target, even if they weren't the first time around. In fact, I'm coming to the conclusion that we may discover a larger reformist movement and commitment than we'd initially anticipated in most places.
A reformist commitment, Caleb repeated, and Stainer nodded again, far more serenely than Charlian suspected she would have been able to in response to the same question.
One step at a time, Caleb, the Archbishop said calmly. One step at a time. Merlin was right when he said God can creep in through the cracks whenever he decides to. But we're going to have to let him do this in his own good time, I think. First, let us correct the gross, obvious abuses. Once we have people in the habit of actually thinking about matters of doctrine and church policy, it will be time to begin suggesting more substantive changes.
He's right, Caleb, Charlian said quietly. Caleb looked at her, and she reached across to touch the side of his face. It was a conversation they'd had often enough, and she knew how bitterly it grated upon his sense of responsibility that he literally dared not rip away the mask, expose the full, noisome extent of the lies and perverted faith which were the entire foundation of the Church of God awaiting. Not doing that was going to be the true supreme challenge of his life.
I know he is love, Caleb replied. I don't have to like it, and I won't pretend I do. But I know he's right. In the meantime, I'm starting to think young Saithwick might actually make a good candidate for the Inner Circle in a year or two, Stainer said.
You're joking, Charlian realized she was sitting bolt upright in her chair, her eyes wide.
I don't know why you should think anything of the sort, Your Majesty.
Stainer's tone was imperturbability itself, although there was a slight twinkle in his eyes, and Charlian felt her own eyes narrowing. Fairman Saithwick was the newly consecrated Archbishop of Emerald, barely 40 years old, less than 37 in Terran standard years in point of fact. He came from a conservative family, and his nomination had been firmly supported by Emerald's House of Knights. That was scarcely the pedigree of a rebellious radical, she thought. Yet, as she studied Stainer's expression, "You're not joking," she said slowly.
"No, I'm not." He smiled gently at her. "You might want to remember that I'm the one with primary responsibility for evaluating Al's reports about the senior clergy," he pointed out. "Given that, I don't suppose it should be too surprising for me to have a somewhat different perspective. On the other hand, you should also remember who it was who nominated him in the first place."
"Narmon," Caleb said thoughtfully.
"Precisely, Your Grace."
Stainer bobbed his head in Caleb's direction in a half-bow.
"You, of course, were never faced with the necessity of making a nomination, given my own fortuitous and vastly qualified presence right there in Telesburg."
Caleb made an indelicate sound, and Stainer chuckled. But then his expression sobered.
"You didn't have that luxury in Coruscant, though, Caleb, and Charlian didn't have it in Chisholm, or Narmon in Emerald. Mind you, I've been quite satisfied with everything I've seen of Brainerd. Both by the way he supported me and the Crown when Charlian organized the Imperial Parliament here in Telesburg, and by the way he supported both of you and me there in Chiraeth since. And I think you've been quite satisfied with him too."
He held Caleb's eye until the Emperor nodded, then shrugged.
"We take what God gives us, and we do the best with it that we can, Caleb," he said simply. "And in this case, I think he's given us some sound timber to work with. Powell Brainerd is a good, solid, reliable man. He's loyal to God and to Charlian, in that order. And however much he might have wished it weren't so, he recognizes how corrupt the vicarate's become. I'm sorry to say I don't think he'll ever be ready for the complete truth, any more than Regis or Baron Green Mountain. but he's just as good a man as they are. Yet I'm actually inclined to think Narmon may have found an even greater treasure in Saithwick."
The Archbishop's lips seemed to twitch for a moment, and he shook his head.
"I'm not at all certain, mind you, but I rather had the impression he was probing to see just how revolutionary, in a doctrinal sense, I was prepared to be. I don't have any idea yet where it is he wants to go, although I'm sure I'll get around to figuring it out soon enough. I'll want a little longer to watch him in action, mind you, but I'm serious. I think that ultimately he may make a very good candidate for the inner circle. And, let's face it, the more senior churchmen we can recruit, the better."
"Well, I doubt anyone could argue with that," Charlian conceded. Then she shook herself and stood. "And on that note, Archbishop Michael, I'm going to call this conference to an end and drag my husband off to bed before he decides to break out the whiskey and stay up all night carousing with you long distance."
"Carousing?" Caleb repeated in injured tones. "I'll have you know that one doesn't carouse with an archbishop."
"I didn't say he'd be the one doing the carousing either," she pointed out with a stern twinkle. "And while it's barely the 20th hour where he is, it's well past 24th here. An empress in my delicate condition needs her sleep. And if I'm going to get any sleep, I need my hot water bottle. I mean, my beloved husband."
She grinned at him.
"I can't imagine how I came to misspeak myself that way."
"Oh, no?"
Caleb climbed out of his own chair, eyes laughing while both of them heard Stainer chuckling over the comm. Charlian regarded him with bright-eyed innocence and shook her head. "Absolutely," she assured him. "I would never think of you in such purely utilitarian and selfish terms. I can't imagine how a phrase like that could have somehow slipped out that way."
"Well, I can," he told her ominously. "And I assure you, young lady, there's going to be a penalty."
"Really?" She cocked her head, then batted her eyes at him. "Oh, goody. Should I ask one of the guardsmen to find us the peach preserves? After all, it's not going to be all that much longer before I start losing the athleticism to really enjoy them, you know."
Caleb made a strangled sound, his face turning a rather alarming shade of red as he fought his laughter, and she giggled delightedly, then looked at the Archbishop and smiled sweetly.
"And on that note, Michael, good night."
2. Archbishop's Palace, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant.
"So, my lord," Archbishop Claremont Gerling kept his tone rather lighter than he actually felt at this particular moment. "Now that you've been here for a 5-day, what do you think?"
"In what regard, Your Eminence?" Bishop Gerald Adamson responded blandly as the Archbishop and his two guests stepped into Gerling's study.
"Gerald?"
Bishop Kaisi McEnroe said, raising one chiding index finger, and Adamson chuckled. Then he looked back at Gerling.
"Forgive me, Your Eminence." There was an edge of contrition in his voice. "I'm afraid my sense of humor sometimes betrays me into unbecoming levity. I think that's at least partly a response to the fact that I used to take myself much too seriously. And as the writ says, God made man to smile as well as to weep."
"That's true enough, my lord," Gerling agreed. "And sometimes laughter is the only way to avoid weeping, I think."
He walked around the desk to the comfortable swivel chair behind it, and a courteous sweep of his right hand indicated the even more comfortable armchairs facing it.
"Please, my knights, make yourselves easy. May I offer you any refreshment?"
"Not for me, thank you, Your Eminence." Adamson seated himself in one of the indicated chairs. "After we've finished our discussions here, I'm dining with Earl Anvil Rock and his son.
I understand Earl Tartarian and at least one or two other members of the Regency Council will be joining us as well. He grimaced humorously. As a bishop executor of Mother Church, I developed a remarkably hard head. Now, as a lowly bishop once more, and given to somewhat more abstemious habits, I don't seem to have quite the capacity where alcohol is concerned before my jokes become a bit too loud and my judgment becomes somewhat less reliable than I think it is. He frowned thoughtfully, rubbing one eyebrow. Or that's one possibility, at any rate. Another is that I never was quite as immune to its effects as I thought I was, but no one had the nerve to point it out to me. He smiled broadly, but then his expression sobered, and he looked very levelly into Gerling's eyes across the Archbishop's desk. Odd, isn't it, how no one seems to want to challenge the judgment of Mother Church's senior clergy? Silence hovered for a moment or two, and then Gerling looked up at the aide who had escorted him and his guests from Manshire Cathedral to the Archbishop's palace. "I think that will be all, Simon," he said. "If I need you, I'll call."
"Of course, Your Eminence."
The dark-haired, dark-complexioned young underpriest's brown cassock bore the scepter of the Order of Langhorne, as did Gerling's orange-trimmed white cassock. And there was a sort of familial resemblance about them, although the underpriest was obviously a native-born Coruscandian. Had he been several years younger, or had Gerling been several years older, he might have been the archbishop's son. As it was, Adamson was relatively certain it was simply a case of a young man modeling his own behavior and demeanor upon that of a superior whom he deeply respected. And it would appear there's quite a bit to respect about the archbishop, Adamson thought. Rather more than there was to respect about me, in the good old days at any rate. His lips twitched again, remembering certain conversations which had once passed between him and then-Bishop Michael Stainer. It was, he reflected, for far from the first time, a very fortunate thing that Stainer's sense of humor was as lively as his compassion was deep. The door closed behind the departing aide, and Gerling returned his attention to his guests. He'd gotten to know MacInroe surprisingly well over the past month or two. Or perhaps not surprisingly well, given how closely he'd been compelled to work with the other man since his own elevation to the primacy of Coruscant and MacInroe's installation as the Bishop of Manshire. He wouldn't have gone quite so far as to describe the two of them as friends yet. Colleagues was undoubtedly a better term, at least this far. They shared a powerful sense of mutual respect, however, and he'd come to appreciate that MacInroe had been chosen for his present position at least in part because he combined a truly formidable intellect with a deep faith and a remarkably deep well of empathy. Despite his installation by a foreign, heretical, schismatic church, he'd already demonstrated a powerful ability to listen to the priests and laity of his bishopric. Not simply to listen, but to convince them he was actually hearing what they said, and that he would not hold frank speaking against them. No one would ever accuse him of weakness or vacillation, but neither could any honest person accuse him of tyranny or intolerance. Adamson, on the other hand, was so far a complete unknown. Gerling knew at least the bare bones of his official history, yet it was already obvious there were quite a lot of things that official history had left out. He knew Adamson had been Archbishop Erech Dinis's bishop executor in Carus before Dinis's fall from grace and eventual execution for heresy and treason. He knew Adamson came from a merely respectable Temple Lands family, with considerably fewer and lower-placed connections than Gerling's own family could boast. He knew Adamson, as Bishop Executor, had more than once reprimanded and disciplined Archbishop Michael Stainer when Stainer had been simply the Bishop of Telisburg.
and that he had been imprisoned, or at least placed under house arrest, following the Kingdom of Carus's decision to openly defy the Church of God Awaiting. And he knew that since that time, Adamson had become one of Steiner's most trusted and valued troubleshooters, which explained his current presence in Coruscant. What Gerling did not know, and what it was becoming rapidly evident to him he'd been mistaken about, was how and why Gerald Adamson had made that transition. He thought about that for a few seconds, then decided forthrightness was probably the best policy. "Forgive me, my lord," he said now, returning Adamson's level regard, "but I've begun to suspect that my original assumptions about how you come to hold your present position, shall we say, may have been somewhat in error."
"Or to put it another way," Adamson said dryly, "your original assumptions were that, having seen the way the wind was blowing in Carus, and realizing that, whatever defense I might present, the Grand Inquisitor and the Chancellor were unlikely to be overjoyed to see me again in the Temple or Zion, I decided to turn my coat, or would that be my cassock, while the turning was good. Would that be about the size of it, Your Eminence?"
That, Gerling decided, was rather more forthrightness than he'd had in mind. Unfortunately. "Well, yes, actually," he confessed, reminding himself that however he'd become one, he was an archbishop while Adamson was merely a bishop. "As I say, I've begun to think I was wrong to believe that, but while I don't believe I'd have phrased it quite that way, that was more or less my original assumption."
"And no doubt exactly the way it was presented to you here in Coruscant before the invasion," Adamson suggested.
"Yes," Gerling said slowly, his tone rather more thoughtful, and Adamson shrugged.
"I don't doubt for a minute that the group of fours presented things that way, whatever they truly think. But neither in this case do I doubt for a moment that that's exactly what they think happened." He grimaced once more. "Partly I'm confident because that's precisely the way they would have been thinking under the same circumstances. But also, I'm very much afraid because they've spoken with people who actually knew me. I hate to admit it, Your Eminence, but my own attitudes, the state of my own faith, at the time this all began, ought to make that a very reasonable hypothesis for those who were well acquainted with me."
"That's a remarkably forthright admission, my lord," Gerling said quietly, his chair squeaking ever so softly as he leaned back in it. "One, I doubt, comes easily to someone who once sat as close to an archbishop's chair as you did."
"It comes more easily than you might think, Your Eminence," Adamson replied. "I don't say it was a pleasant truth to face when I first had to, you understand, but I've discovered the truth is the truth. We can hide from it, and we can deny it, but we can't change it. And I've spent at least 2/3 of my allotted span here on Safehold ignoring it. That doesn't give me a great deal of time to work on balancing the ledger before I'm called to render my accounts before God. Under the circumstances, I don't think I should waste any of it in pointless evasions."
"I see," Gerling said. "And I'm beginning to think I see why Steiner trusted you enough to send you here in his name," the Archbishop added silently. "But since you've been so frank, my lord, may I ask what actually led you to face the truth, as you put it, in the first place?"
"Quite a few things," Adamson replied, sitting back in his own chair and crossing his legs. "One of them, to be honest, was the fact that I realized what sort of punishment I would face if I ever did return to the Temple lands. Trust me, that was enough to give anyone pause, even before that butcher, Clinton, had Archbishop Arake tortured to death."
The ex-bishop executor's face tightened for a moment.
"I doubt any of us senior members of the priesthood ever actually gave much thought to having the penalty of Schuler levied against us. That was a threat, a club, to hold over the heads of the laity in order to frighten them into doing God's will, which, of course, had been revealed to us with perfect clarity.
Adamson's biting tone could have chewed chunks out of the marble facade of Gerling's palace, and his eyes were hard.
So I hadn't actually anticipated that I might be tortured to death on the very steps of the temple, he continued. I'd accepted that my fate was going to be unpleasant, you understand, but it never crossed my mind to fear that. So I'd expected, at least initially, that I'd be incarcerated somewhere in Caris, probably until the legitimate forces of Mother Church managed to liberate me, at which point I would be disciplined and sent to rusticate in disgrace, milking goats and making cheese in some obscure monastic community up in the Mountains of Light. Trust me, at the time I expected that to be more than sufficient punishment for someone of my own exquisite Epicurean tastes.
He paused and looked down, and his eyes softened briefly, as if at some memory, as he stroked one sleeve of his remarkably plain cassock. Then he looked back up at Gerling, and the softness had vanished.
But then we learned in Telesburg what had happened to the Archbishop, he said flatly. More than that, I received a letter from him, one he managed to have smuggled out before his execution.
Gerling's eyes widened, and Adamson nodded.
It was written on a blank page he'd taken from a copy of the Holy Writ, Your Eminence, he said softly. I found that remarkably symbolic under the circumstances, and in it he told me his arrest, his trial, and his conviction had brought him face to face with the truth, and that he hadn't liked what he'd seen. It was a brief letter. He had only the single sheet of paper, and I think he was writing in haste, lest one of his guards surprise him at the task. But he told me, ordered me, as my ecclesiastic superior, not to return to Zion. He told me what his own sentence had been, and what mine would undoubtedly be if I fell into Clinton's hands. And he told me Clinton's inquisitors had promised him an easy death if he would condemn Stainer and the rest of the Church of Caris hierarchy for apostasy and heresy. If he would confirm the Group of Four's version of the reason they'd chosen to lay waste to an innocent kingdom. But he refused to do that. I'm sure you've heard what he actually said, and I'm sure you've wondered if what you heard was the truth, or some lie created by Carisian propagandists.
He smiled without any humor at all.
It would certainly have occurred to me to wonder about that after all, but I assure you, it was no lie. From the very scaffold on which he was to die, he rejected the lies the Group of Four had demanded of him. He rejected the easy death they'd promised him, because that truth he'd finally faced was more important to him, there at the very end of his life, than anything else.
It was very quiet in Gerling's study. The slow, measured ticking of the clock on one of the Archbishop's bookcases was almost thunderous in the stillness. Adamson let that silence linger for several moments, then shrugged.
Your Eminence, I knew the reality of the highest levels of Mother Church's hierarchy, just as I'm sure you've known them. I knew why Clinton had the Archbishop sentenced. Why, for the first time ever, the penalty of Schuler was applied to a senior member of the episcopate. And I knew that, whatever his faults, and Langhorne knows they were almost as legion as my own, Irake Dinis did not deserve to die that sort of death, simply as a way for a hopelessly corrupt vicarate to prop up its own authority. I looked around me in Caris, and I saw men and women who believed in God, not in the corrupt power and ambition of men like Jaspar Clinton. And when I saw that, I saw something I wanted to be. I saw something that convinced me that, even at that later date, I might have a true vocation. Langhorne knows it took God a while to find a hammer big enough to pound that possibility through a skull as thick as mine, but he'd managed it in the end. And in my own possibly long-winded way, that's the answer to your question. It's not the answer to all of my questions, not yet, I'm afraid, but it's something just as important. It's the start of all my questions, and I've discovered that, unlike the days when I was Mother Church's consecrated vice-regent for Caris, with all the pomp and power of that office, I'm eager to find answers to those questions.
Adamson drew a deep breath, then he shrugged.
I'm no longer a bishop executor, Your Eminence. The Church of Caris doesn't have those, but even if it did, I wouldn't be one again. Assuming anyone would trust me to be one after the outstanding job I did last time around.
It was no smile this time. It was a broad, flashing grin, well-suited to any youngster explaining that fairies had just emptied the cookie jar. Then it faded again, but now the eyes were no longer hard, the voice no longer burdened with memories of anger and guilt. He looked at Gerling from a face of hard-won serenity, and his voice was equally serene.
I'm something far more important than a bishop executor now, Your Eminence. I'm a priest. Perhaps for the first time in my entire life, really, I'm a priest.
He shook his head.
Frankly, that would be far too hard an act for any high episcopal office to follow.
Gerling gazed back at him for a long, thoughtful moment, then looked at McEnroe. None of that had been the answer he'd expected out of Gerald Adamson, yet somehow it never occurred to him for a moment to doubt the other man's sincerity.
Which is the biggest surprise of all, really, he thought. And where does that leave you, Claremont?
He thought about that carefully. He was the consecrated Archbishop of Coruscant, as far as the Church of Caris was concerned. Which, of course, made him an utterly damned apostate heretic where the Church of God Awaiting was concerned. After what had happened to Araik Dinis, as Adamson had just reminded him, there was no doubt in his mind what would happen if he or Adamson or McEnroe ever fell into the hands of the Inquisition. That was a thought fit to wake a man wrapped in the cold sweat of nightmares, and it had on more than one occasion. In fact, it had awakened him often, making him wonder what in the world, what in God's name, he'd thought he was doing when he accepted his present office. And now this. As Archbishop, he was Adamson's ecclesiastic superior. Of course, Adamson wasn't assigned to his archbishopric, so he'd properly come under Gerling's orders only when those orders did not, in any way, conflict with instructions he'd already received from Michael Stainer. Still, in this princedom, in this archbishopric and this office, Adamson could neither give Gerling orders nor pass judgment upon him. All he could do was report back to Stainer, who was thousands of miles away in Chisholm, assuming he'd met his planned travel schedule, or even farther away than that, in Emerald, or in transit between Erastor and Chiraeth, if his schedule had slipped. Yet Adamson was Stainer's personal representative. He was here specifically to smooth the way, prepare the ground for Stainer's first pastoral visit to Coruscant. Despite everything, Gerling had expected a far more overtly political representative, especially given Adamson's hierarchical pedigree. But what he'd gotten raised almost as many questions in his own mind, questions about himself, as they'd answered about Gerald Adamson.
My lord, he said finally, I'm honored by the honesty with which you've described your own feelings and beliefs, and I'll be honest and say it had never occurred to me that you might have sustained that degree of genuine spiritual regeneration.
He raised one hand, waving it gently above his desk.
I don't mean to imply that I believed you'd accepted your present office solely out of some sort of cynical ambition, trying to make the best deal that you could out of the situation which had come completely apart for you in Caris. But I must confess I'd done you a grave disservice and assumed that was much of what had happened. Now, after what you've just said, I find myself in a bit of a quandary.
A quandary, Your Eminence?
Adamson arched one eyebrow and Gerling snorted.
Honesty deserves honesty, my lord, especially between men who both claim to be servants of God, he said.
Your Eminence, I doubt very much that you could, in honesty, tell me anything that would come as a tremendous surprise,
Adamson said dryly.
For example, I would be surprised, enormously surprised, to discover that you had accepted your present archbishopric solely out of a sense of deep loyalty and commitment to the Empire of Caris.
Well,
Gerling's voice was even drier than Adamson's had been.
I believe I can safely set your mind to rest upon that point. However,
he leaned forward slightly, and his expression became far more serious, even somber.
I must admit that despite my very best efforts, I felt more than one mental reservation when I took the vows of my new office.
Adamson cocked his head to one side, and Gerling glanced quickly at Mockenroe. This wasn't something he'd admitted to the Bishop of Manchir, yet he saw only calm interest in the other man's eyes before he looked back at Adamson.
First, I would never have accepted this office under any circumstances if I hadn't agreed Mother Church, or the vicarate at least, has become hopelessly corrupt. And when I say hopelessly, that's exactly the word I meant to use. If I'd believed for one moment that someone like Zomson Trenaire might demand reform, or that someone like Jasper Clinton would have permitted it if he had, I would have refused the archbishopric outright and immediately. But saying I believe Mother Church has been mortally wounded by her own vicars isn't the same thing as saying I believe the Church of Caris must automatically be correct. Nor does it mean I'm somehow magically free of any suspicion that the Church of Caris has been co-opted by the Empire of Caris. Mother Church may have fallen into evil, but she was never intended to be the servant of secular political ambitions, and I won't willingly serve any church which is no more than a political tool.
He grimaced.
The spiritual rot in Zion is itself the result of the perversion of religion in pursuit of power, and I'm not prepared simply to substitute perversion in the name of the power of princes for perversion in the name of the power of prelates.
Granted, Adamson nodded. Yet the problem, of course, is that the Church of Caris can survive only so long as the Empire of Caris is able to protect it. The two are inextricably bound up with one another, in that respect at least, and there are inevitably going to be times when religious policy is shaped by and reflects political policy. And the reverse, I assure you.
I don't doubt that for a moment.
Gerling reached up and squeezed the bridge of his nose gently between thumb and forefinger.
The situation is so incredibly complicated, with so many factions, so many dangers, that it could hardly be any other way.
He lowered his hand and looked directly at Adamson.
Still, if the Church is seen as a creature of the Empire, she will never gain general acceptance in Coruscant. Not unless something changes more dramatically than I can presently imagine. In that regard, it would have been far better if she had been renamed the Reform Church, perhaps, instead of the Church of Caris.
That was considered, Adamson told him. It was rejected because, ultimately, the group of four was inevitably going to label it the Church of Caris, whatever we called it. That being so, it seemed better to go ahead and embrace the title ourselves. I speak here using the ecclesiastic we, of course, he explained with a charming smile, since I was not myself party to that particular decision. And another part of it, obviously, was that mutual dependence upon one another for survival, which I've already mentioned.
In the end, I think, the decision was that honesty and forthrightness were more important than the political or propaganda nuances of the name.
Perhaps so, but that doesn't magically expunge the unfortunate association in the minds of a great many Coruscandians.
Or, for that matter, in my own mind, and I was scarcely born here in Coruscant myself.
Gerling shook his head.
I don't claim to understand all of my own motivations myself, my lord. I think any man who pretends he does is guilty of self-deception, at the very least. However, my primary reasons for accepting this office were four. First, my belief, as I've already said, that Mother Church has gone too far down the path of corruption under her current hierarchy to be internally reformed. If reform is even possible for her at this late date, it will happen only because an external threat has forced it upon the vicarate, and as I see it, the Church of Carus represents that external threat, that external demand for change. Second, because I desire, above almost all other things, to prevent or at least mitigate the religious persecutions and counter-persecutions I dread when I look at a conflict such as this one. Men's passions are seldom so inflamed as when they grapple with issues of the soul, my lord. Be you personally ever so priestly, be Archbishop Michael ever so gentle, violence, vengeance, and counter-vengeance will play their part soon enough. That isn't an indictment of you, nor even an indictment of the Church of Carus. The Group of Four began it, not you, when they launched five other princedoms at the Kingdom of Carus's throat. But in its way, that only proves my point, and what happened at Farade only underscores it. I do not wish to see that cycle launched here in Coruscant, and when this office was offered to me, I saw it as my best opportunity to do something to at least moderate it in the princedom which has become my home.
He paused, regarding Adamson steadily until the other man nodded slowly.